The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Yes, coming to you cordless, everybody. It's 11:02 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, 2 minutes after 2 p.m. in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia, and here where I'm sitting in Northeast Minneapolis, it's 10:02 p.m., and welcome to another edition of Jim Peters and Knight. This is a very special edition. It's our 50th show. We started on July 31st, which, if you can do your math in your head, is a day before August 1st, but it was a Monday, so we did that. So we've done 50 shows so far. This is our 14th week, and I got to thank you. We're just about to bust 900 followers on Rumble, and I can't thank you enough. That's very cool. I checked about an hour ago. I think it's the count right now is 889, I think. But yeah, so we're on our way there, and not only that, we got a fantastic guest for you today, and a very, very VIP important guy. Michael Harrison is the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine, which is the industry trade publication for talk media in the United States, both talk radio, talk TV, and podcasts. They do that whole thing. This guy has had quite a life. I mean, he's done like everything. We've already done the interview. When I run it at the top of it, I give just a short rundown of some of his credits. He invented the AOR, or the album-oriented rock format, in the 1970s. Sean Hannity has called him the single most important person in talk radio in the United States. He's a fantastic guy, so you're going to love this. We talk about a lot of stuff. He's really into technology. We're both old dudes. I mean, you know, it's like he doesn't look a day over 40, but we're about the same age. So I'm in my late 60s now. Like, you know, if you watch the show, you know that because I bitch and moan about it all the time. Anyway, he's our guest tonight. Tomorrow night, Jeff Meyer, the CEO and publisher of Conk News. Now, you know, you may not agree with what Jeff thinks, but he's always got a really interesting take on stuff. He's very unique, and that's the reason we have him on. It's like you won't hear any news from another perspective like this ever. So, anyway, so yeah, he's tomorrow. Nobody for Thursday. Don't got anybody for Thursday. Next Wednesday, we're doing a very special, it's the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination. We're doing a very special episode. Now, here's the deal. I was trying to put together a panel for this, and I think I've struck out. People are falling in and out of this, and I've kind of decided to screw it, because here's the deal. I have a very specific theory on what happened to Dealey Plaza that day in 1963, and it takes me about 45 minutes to explain it. So I'm thinking right now, I think I'm going to do the show alone. I think you're going to hear my theory. Last year, on a podcast or radio show, I can't remember what we were doing at that time. I did the same show where it was me. And I outlined my theory. I've been studying this for years. As I've said many times, I'm not a researcher. I'm a meta-researcher. I research other people's research. So that I've just gathered it all together. And I try. It's like putting together a puzzle, trying to see what fits what other people said, unbeknownst to what other people said, and see if they actually match up. So that's what I've done. That's what I did with the UFO stuff. And yeah, so and here I sit. So that's our show tonight, if you want to call in, I tell you what, I'm not taking calls to the third section here. We do have some UFO and paranormal news tonight, too, that we're going to do after the interview, which is our part three, our third block, which is what that oral is. You can call in. You have to go to jimandknight.com/call. You can also leave me a text or a voicemail at this number, 408-458-5088. You can remember that, 408-458-5088. And if you're the guy who's been bitching and moaning about the fact I don't wash my hair, I don't want to hear about it tonight, okay? See, it's TV. You can't smell me. Got that? Okay, so what happened today? I'll tell you what happened today. The numbers for the monthly inflation numbers came out from the General Accounting Office, and actually those numbers are pretty good. According to them, there was no increase or decrease. There's no change in inflation from October, or actually I think September. These were the October numbers. So that was all pretty fine and good. But what they didn't mention, and what the Biden administration won't tell you, is that the day before, that would be, Friday or Monday, Moody's Investment Services downgraded the government of the United States as an investment instrument from AAA to AA. So yeah, we're not as good investment as we used to be, apparently. And that's because we are $33.6 trillion in debt. Can you say trillion? Trillion. $33.6 trillion in debt. And last week, the other thing that happened, we've already talked about on the show, and that is the payments, the annual payments on that debt, the interest payments, have now crossed $1 trillion. That's just on interest. In other words, that's not money that's being used for any useful purpose other than making banks fat and happy. That's it. You were paying up $1 trillion in debt. There you go. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Now, I'm bringing this up because major economists are still predicting, even though these numbers were good today, and of course the Biden administration was rah, 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 major economists are still predicting that we're going to have a major recession in 2024, including our favorite economist here, Murray Sabrin, who sent out another, if you subscribe to his Substack mailing list, which about half the mailings are free, and there's a link on our blog at jimandknight.com to that. I think his last appearance was last week or the week before. I can't remember. He comes on about, we have a number of guests here who come on roughly every 4 to 6 weeks. So, and he's one of them. Because I love talking about the economy, and nobody in America knows anything about economics, which is just really strange and weird, and I've decided that's a liberal plot, the fact that we don't teach economics in high school. There's a reason for that, and that is, and this is, now I'm not pulling this figure out of my butt, it's a straight 45-degree graph, I think it was New York University, that said, they basically determined that the more formal formal training you have in economics, the more likely you are to be conservative. And I've said this before, I'm a former liberal, and one of the many reasons I became a conservative is because I finally realized studying economics, I came to the same realization almost everybody does at some point, and that is liberal fiscal policy simply doesn't work. It does not work. You know, Paul Krugman, the guy who writes for the New York Times, he's a complete outlier. I mean, you know, you got him and you got 10,000 other economists who disagree with him, including me. I'm not an economist, but I still disagree with him. So anyway, so that happened today. So what else happened today? There was a protest, if you want to call it, a rally, in Washington, D.C. for Israel and the Jewish people. About 100,000 people showed up. Now, that's a pretty damn big rally. I think that's bigger than any of the gatherings that have been pro-Hamas or pro-Palestine, maybe with a possible exception of the one that was in New York City, with one of them. Maybe. I don't know. I think there were about 50,000 people that showed up for this. They're saying about 100,000 people showed up for this. And I want to point this out because this always gets lost in this. That's not even close to the people who showed up, the number of people who showed up for the rally on January 6th, not the storming of the Capitol, the actual rally ahead of time. Supposedly, 500,000 people showed up for that. And some people think that was the estimate of the Capitol Police, and some people think that estimate's even low. Some people think it might have been a million. It was easily the most number of people that ever showed up at a rally in Washington, D.C. ever. Not even close, apparently. That was 500,000 people. Well, 100,000 people showed up for this. They were very peaceful. They rah rah rah. They made their speeches. You know, they're supporting Israel, and they're against Hamas. And God bless them. They took care of that, and I'm glad they did. And somebody did, because we have a problem right now. David Strom was talking about this when he was on the show a couple weeks ago, and this is he's really got a good point, and that is we are being inundated with what is essentially propaganda. And that is, there's a lot of people I know who are pro-Hamas and pro-Palestine, and that's fine. But the thing is, one of the reasons they're doing these so many of these pro-Palestine rallies is to convince the public that there's more people that support this than really do. When in reality, every poll taken shows that the vast majority of Americans are with Israel on this. So I find it really funny when Rashida Tlaib gets up or does a TikTok video, whatever the hell it was, and she said, you know, the American people are not going to forget this. Well, the American people aren't with her, you know. And now I don't know if she doesn't know that or she's delusional. And I've got, speaking of delusional, I'm getting to that in just a second. I don't know. I'm guessing it's propaganda again. They're inflating their numbers because they want more people to think that there's many more people with them than there is. But as Strom said, this is how propaganda works. In the last, 2 weeks? So the war in Israel has been going on now for about a month. In the last 2 weeks, the majority of Democrats, it's not a large majority, but it's flipped from pro-Israel to pro-Palestine or pro-Hamas. I'm not even going to talk about the Palestinian people. For all practical purposes, Hamas has them hostage. So, yeah, so it's really interesting because I think it went from like 53-47 pro-Israel to like 47-53 pro-Hamas, believe it or not. Yeah, so in other words, this protesting is having the desired effect. They are convincing people, and when I mean people, I mean Democrats and liberals. They're convincing them that maybe people should start getting in line, you know, with what they're thinking. And I don't know. I mean, I could be an evil person and say that I think Democrats are much more easily swayed than Republicans, or liberals are much more swayed than conservatives, who basically kind of stick by their guns. Actually, to a, sometimes a deteriorous effect. Did I say that right? You know. So the thing that here's the speaking of that effect. Okay, so, you know, we just had an election a couple weeks ago. Not a lot of voting across the country. I did not vote here in Minneapolis because I looked at the sample ballot. The only single thing on it was my city council person. And believe it or not, the choice was between Democratic Party and Socialist Party. That was the choice. And that's because I live in one of the most liberal cities in America. Minneapolis doesn't get a lot of attention for this, but it is. We haven't had a conservative city council member for Minneapolis in 20 years, and we haven't had more than one in 50 years. So I didn't vote. I'm a conscientious conscientious citizen, but I looked at that and said, well, that's not a choice. I'll leave it to other people. You know, I'm assuming the Democrat won. I'm assuming that, but I didn't even bother to check, you know. Oh, so where was I going with that? Oh my God. It's like, Jesus, am I not going to like flip out all, you know, figuring what I'm doing already here. Am I? No, I'm not. No. So, yeah. So anyway, like I said, that propaganda, if you want to call it that, of who's showing up for the pro-Palestine rallies is having an effect on I don't know the general public, but at least liberals and Democrats, it is. They are starting to change their. I mean, you even see the White House went from being, and you know, they got applauded for this. I don't blame them, from being extremely pro-Israel, and now they're starting to soften a little bit. We need a ceasefire, you know, blah, 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 you know. And meanwhile, Hamas puts their command centers right underneath hospitals. Yeah, because the thing is, so what do? If Israel bombs a hospital, look at all the children, women and children they killed. If Israel doesn't bomb the hospital, they get bombed. It's and so, you know, people are blaming Israel for this, and yet Hamas is essentially holding their own citizens hostage, like I said just a few seconds ago. They are. They don't care. They do not care about their own citizens. They only care about wiping Israel off the map. And the really amazing thing here, and there's a lot of people at this rally who talked about this today. I mean, years ago, and when I say years ago, I'm even talking about like 3 years ago, they kind of hid this, you know. Now they're actually overt in what they want to do. They're coming straight out and saying, no, we want to kill all Jews. They have no qualms in saying it now at all. None. And then I'm listening to people on campus, these stupid children who, you know, don't have jobs. I was talking about last night. And here's another thing, too. So we got done with the show at about 11:30 last night, and or 11 o'clock or Central Time, midnight Eastern. And I watch Gutfeld basically when I get done here. Ha, ha, ha. You know, a little before I wind down. And his monologue. So, I mean, I didn't crypt him. If anything, he crypt me, but I'm sure he didn't. His monologue was virtually exactly the same as mine at the top of the show. And that is, he said, most of these people, or these college students, are not only uninformed, they're also unemployed. It's like, this is their thing. This is what they do. They don't have any real lives. They don't know that. But they're just out there. Their lives are protesting. They're social justice warriors. They're going to make the world a better place. Yeah, tell me about it. Right, like what they know. They don't know shit. And they don't even bother to educate themselves about this conflict. Like I said last night, I think it was Jesse Waters or some cable TV show sent somebody out into the, maybe it was even CBS News, send somebody out into the crowds at these college protests and ask them specific questions of what was actually going on there or historically what Hamas has done. Kids didn't know anything, nothing. You know, it's like you remember when Jay Leno used to do that thing, jaywalking on The Tonight Show years ago, and people say, well, how many people, you must have to interview a lot of people to get such stupid answers. And he's like, no. No, it's pretty much everybody, and I know he's right. I know that. I've been around enough to know that's true. You know. You stop anybody in the street. I mean, the last statistic I heard, I think, is that 89% of Americans can't name the current vice president. And I'm not talking about Kamala. I'm talking about any of them. You know, this is a steady, stable figure for many years. 89%, almost all Americans can't name the vice president. It's absurd. So, Michael Harrison, in a few minutes, he's going to talk about this, about the fact that Americans are kind of, we're stupid. By and large, we're really stupid. And I don't suppose that surprises anybody, but I was talking about how people are delusional. And, you know, I've said this in the past, that I can't tell if Joe Biden is senile or actually delusional or stupid. But I'm starting to come to the conclusion it's delusional. So you probably have heard this, you know, the Democratic machine is now ramping up to try to get Biden to step down, or not step down, but not run for re-election, right? So David Axelrod, basically Obama's hitman, for the second weekend in a row, he got on the cable news shows and was talking about how Joe really should not run for re-election again. Now, if that's happening, and it's happening, you know, more than once, and this guy's pretty high up in the food chain in the Democratic Party, you know this is a concerted effort at this point. They do not want this guy to run. Why? Because they think he's going to lose. And right now, I think that's probably true. Barring, you know, if he runs against Trump, I think at this time, Trump might beat him. You know, and I won't get into the fact that I think Trump beat him the last time, but you know, that's my opinion. You know, right? I'm one of those election deniers. I am, but like, I have no proof. You know, I have evidence, but I have no proof. That's what I've always said. I won't get into the evidence. I brought it up many times on the show, so I'm not going to bore you with it right now. But the thing, so Axelrod's on TV talking about this, and apparently, and you know, here's the deal. Even though I don't like Biden, this has been done not just to Trump, but even historically going into the past where they said, well, people close to him or his staff or somebody said he said, the president said, a lot of times it's bullshit. Somebody just makes it up. So who knows? But this makes sense, though, that apparently Biden called Axelrod privately a prick. That's the word he used, apparently. And that wouldn't surprise me because Joe has I don't know if you figured this out, has a really quick temper. That's been established now. He gets really pissed off. And apparently he thinks he's doing a really good job and that and people are noticing. Now, and this is a part where he's delusional. He is. He keeps bringing up Bidenomics and the fact that the last three elections, midterm elections, have gone really well. And I guess that's true. But the thing is, I've thought about this. You got a guy here who's never had a real, he worked for 1 year in a law firm before he entered politics. He's virtually never had a real job ever. And I think politicians, and we've talked about this famously, because the founding fathers, the reason there are no term limits in the Constitution is because it never occurred to them that somebody would want to be in Congress as a full-time job. That was never the intent. It never even occurred to them. And when you stop and think about all the stuff that did occur to them in the Constitution, I mean, there's some of the stuff's really, really well thought out. I mean, really well thought out. You know, like succession or, how to pass bills, all the sorts. It's very, very thought out. But no term limits, because it never occurred to them that anybody would want to do this. So you got a swamp creature like Biden, who's literally been in Washington his entire life, like almost 50 years, And I think he thinks that passing bills or getting bills passed is an accomplishment. And it isn't. And the thing is, and I hate to bring this up because by extension, I'm talking about people in service industries. And that is, if you work in construction or you're building lasers or something, you actually build stuff. You're actually creating stuff, right? And a lot of people are doing this. A lot of people, even if you're low on the totem pole, if you're out, if you build houses for, Del Webb or whoever the hell it is, and you're nailing 2x4s, you drive by that house and you say, well, I helped build that. It's like all the people who talked about all the guys who had such incredible pride for working on the Golden Gate Bridge. They're nameless. We don't know who they are. And apparently a few of them are still alive. But, they drive over the bridge and, well, I helped build that. There's a sense of pride. You're actually, doing something. If you're in a service industry, or heaven forbid, if you're working in the bureaucracy of the government, you aren't really creating anything. You're basically pushing papers, And I understand that for those people, life can be kind of frustrating because you don't get the satisfaction of creation. You can't point to anything and say, well, I did that. You can't do it. Or even that you helped, It's like working at the DMV. But the thing is, that goes up to every step and every level of government, including elected officials. I know people are going to give me a hard time for this. I don't care. Being in Congress is not an accomplishment. First of all, you won a popularity contest. It's basically like being in high school. I've always said this because I've been working in the media my entire life. I would have no trouble running and winning office. To me, that's a snap. Now, doing the job, no. I don't have the constitution for it. I don't have the personality to do it. And that's why I don't, but as far as running, oh yeah, I could run because there are two different things. Running is show business, being actually doing the job is the drudgery of bureaucracy. And I can't stomach it. I can't. And not to mention the fact, just because of my personality, I know I would not be good at it. So I'm not going there. But the thing is, what my point is, being in Congress is not an accomplishment. You're passing bills. You're doing the citizens' work. It's a service. And that was always the idea of people who did this. This was the idea of the founding fathers. You would put down your plow and go to Washington for whatever it is, 2, 5, 10, 12 years. You'd serve your country, and you'd go back home and grab your plow up and make more money. That was the idea. And it worked great until basically Franklin Roosevelt. Now, he wasn't the first president who actually ran for a third term, but he was the first one to win one. I mean, I don't know all of them. I know Teddy Roosevelt, very famously in 1905, tried running for a third term. That was after he did two. And then he stepped down, which was the custom at that time and always has been, you know. And he decided he didn't like the way things are going, and he tried running for a third term kind of after the fact. It was not consecutive. It'll be really interesting. If Trump wins in 2024, he will be only Grover Cleveland has done non-consecutive terms in office. So, when Roosevelt ran for a third term, and that would have been in 28, I think. Do I got that right? No. What am I thinking? It would be in 40, I think. Ran for the third term and won. That's the first time that happened. So he ran for a fourth term and won in 44, and became president for the fourth term in 45 and died like 2 months into his fourth term. He died almost right away. But it behooves people to remember how quickly Congress got their shit together and passed what was the 28th Amendment that limited the president to two terms. It's actually two terms or 10 years total. If you're a vice president, you succeed through death. That happened very quickly because the Congress was not going to put up with the shit anymore. We're not going to let this happen again. So it would happen very quickly after Roosevelt died. And Roosevelt was personally very popular. I mean, you could make, I'm coming to the conclusion, and Murray Sabrins talked about this too, that he was, as a president, he was overrated. He did not really end the Depression, even though he got credit for that. Matter of fact, he extended it. And you could make an argument, and I have too, they didn't know enough about capitalism at that time to know what to do. But actually, Murray disagrees with me. He said that it was just a bald-faced grab for power and that they actually knew what they were doing and it didn't work, and anybody could have told them it would want to work, but they didn't figure that out. So anyway, my point is I've come to the conclusion that Biden thinks he's actually done stuff, and he hasn't. He hasn't done anything. He's not, it's obvious, even the stuff that's worked, he has not been in control of the situation. He isn't, and I think he thinks he is. So it's going to be really interesting what happens here. Are they going to get rid of him? I don't think so. I think he's going to end up actually running. I think, you know, I mean, Strom brought this up, and Sabrin brought this up too. David Strom was on the show last week. And I think even Jazz Shaw brought this up, that, you know, they could make a change at the convention, but it would be really, really messy, and they would really hurt an old man's feelings. they would. That doesn't seem to happen anymore. I mean, up till about 1970, these conventions were, they, all sorts of shit happened and that people weren't expecting. But now they're pretty much scripted and coordinated, and everybody knows what's going to happen. I don't know if they would. I don't know. I don't even know if they could do it anymore. You know, they're pushing Michelle Obama to run for president. Oh, that'll work out. You know, like, she has a lot of experience. And, you know, I sound cynical, but here's the deal. One of the reasons I think Trump was such a good president, and by the way, I'm so tired of hearing people say that if Trump gets reelected, our democracy is going to end. He's already been president once, and it went great. Why do you think I support him? Yeah, look, he may not be the nicest guy on the planet, and he doesn't say nice things. I understand that. I don't mean, well, you know, our president shouldn't be so rude, blah, 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 blah. And maybe that's true. Maybe it is. I don't care. All I care about is, what do you do? You know, it's like Gutfeld says, it's deeds and not words. You know, what have you done? Well, he ran the government pretty damn well. He ran the economy like a fiddle. If there's any fairness in the world, even if Trump doesn't become president again, when it comes to rating presidents on the economy, Trump should be number one because he actually knew what he was doing. I've had my friends tell me, well, you know, the president doesn't actually have that much control over the economy. Yeah, that's true if you don't know what you're doing, which is the case of the vast majority of the time. We have the vast majority of presidents, well, even Republicans, don't know what they're doing. You know, the last two presidents who actually knew what they were doing when it came to the economy are Trump and Clinton. And the amazing thing is, like I've said this before, is they have a lot in common in the sense that conservatives had a visceral hatred for Clinton, almost the same way liberals do for Trump. That's really amazing. But they both had that talent. You know, now, yeah, you can tell me that, Clinton's a horn dog and shouldn't, you know, and you can tell me that, I'm pretty certain Trump had sex with Stormy Daniels, all that sort of stuff. I gotta admit, I don't care. Just do a good job and don't screw us. Now we have a president who looks like he made millions of dollars off of a shilling for the American public. I mean, that's another thing I got here too. I'm checking time. Comer said today, James Comer, head of the House Oversight Committee, that basically they have the smoking gun. And we've had, like, Jazz Shaw came on the show, like, 2 months ago and said that he had heard that through the grapevine that they actually had the smoking gun. They were sitting on it. They're going to continue to sit on it because apparently they want this to come out in these subpoena hearings. But, yeah, they said they have traced money directly from a foreign entity into Joe Biden's bank account. Now, the only thing about that is, and the Democrats do have a point, and that is he wasn't president at that time, you know, and as a matter of fact, in a lot of these instances, he was even out of office. But there's also, we know for a fact, there's incidences where he was in office as vice president, and that's actually where all this comes from. What was a Biden family selling? That's the question. And it's obvious. Access to him. They were selling influence. That's what they were selling. You know, the thing is, if this was a regular RICO trial, you know, where you're talking about mobsters, they already have way enough proof to put everybody in jail, like, forever. I mean, that's the thing. Everyone's making an exception here because this guy's president. Now, whether you should make that exception, I don't know. If you've made $20 million off of the backs of the American public, for basically selling favors while you're vice president, I don't think that should be excused. I don't. I don't excuse that. I excuse Clinton and the cigar, and I excuse Trump and Stormy Daniels and grabbing the vagina and all that sort of stuff. I excuse that because it doesn't have anything to do with the job. It may not be nice. It may not be moral. You know, yeah, I understand. I mean, I know Democrats who still hate Bill Clinton's guts for that stuff, let alone Republicans, you know. But the thing is, doing the job of president in the modern era is so goddamn difficult to get anything done. I mean, you know, the swamp is basically, or the permanent bureaucracy is a better way to put it. It's like a giant, giant fucking aircraft carrier, and you're trying to turn it on a dime. I mean, it's like, it's almost impossible. So if you have the talent to do that, I'd forgive almost anything. Pardon me. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. We're going to play our interview now with Michael Harrison. It's our 50th show. Thank you for watching. I really appreciate it. Here we go. Okay. Our guest today is like the most important person in talk radio in America. And yeah, I'm saying that because the reason here, I got some quotes. Sean Hannity himself said, all right, I got to bring this up. He said that you are the single most important voice in the talk radio industry. You coined the term album oriented rock and basically invented the format. You were, you're the first managing editor of Radio and Records. You founded Talkers Magazine, what, 33 years ago, right?
It's hard to believe.
Especially because you don't look a day over 40. And you're currently serving as executive advisor for the United Nations on the development of World Radio Day for February 13th, 2024. That's actually pretty cool. Is that a big job?
It's a very, very demanding job, and it's challenging me because I'm dealing with radio around the world as opposed to in the US. Here in the US, we tend to think that we're the center of everybody's thoughts. But Europe is quite a big, powerful place. Africa is quite a big, powerful place. Asia, you have India. I'm dealing with radio in the Caribbean, the Pacific Islands. Not to mention, there's a tremendous concern at the United Nations with diplomacy. So, some of the words that I might use in my writing, because I'm writing things and describing the various aspects of World Radio Day for the United Nations, specifically for UNESCO, and some of the words you use that that we think of as just being plain old words could trigger hostility, could insult people.
Do you have to run your all your writings by somebody there or?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am the executive advisor. I'm not the executive producer. I'm an advisor. I'm advising them on various aspects of how this year's theme, Radio, a Century of Informing, Entertaining, and Educating. The
Before we
theme
go
was,
on, Michael, I never
yeah.
mentioned your name. You're Michael Harrison. You're the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine. I should mention that. All right, now I have a question about what you're just talking about. My family's from Eastern Europe. I've spent a lot of time over there. Shortwave radio used to be a big thing there. Is it still?
It's still a big thing in the world. And shortwave radio is a big thing in terms of the first 100-year history of radio. Where it's going, I'm not sure. But it still exists. Not only there are a tremendous number of shortwave operators right here in the United States. It's pretty amazing.
Well, how come commercially that never caught on in the US? Why is that?
Well, there's been enough frequency and opportunity for people to do it on the AM and then the FM dial, I would imagine. Frankly, I don't have an answer for that. That's you stumped me. I don't know why it never caught on commercially.
I mean, you're right. There's a lot of people doing it in the US, but it never really caught on commercially. That's the thing.
It has a different psychology to it. It's not a mass medium. It's kind of mass, but it's not as mass media as certainly AM radio was at the beginning of the 20th century. AM radio was the first electronic mass medium, and I guess it just stayed part of the tradition. Nothing's written in stone. Things develop momentum and they start to become a habit and they become a tradition. It isn't just like, well, why isn't this that way? Or, why did we have the British invasion and not the Italian invasion or the French invasion in terms of music? Just it's the way things fall out. But I'm going to look into that. I don't know much about, frankly, the history of the commercial aspect or potential of shortwave.
Well, you just brought this up, so let's go right there. So, the future of radio. First of all, there's a big move in the last 12 months to basically take AM radio out of cars, and that got thwarted. But I got to tell you, most of the young people I know don't even know what AM radio is. I mean,
That's in the United States,
yes, right.
and it's in the more populated, sophisticated areas of the United States. There are a lot of rural areas in the US, and millions of people live in places where they don't have fully developed Wi-Fi. And AM radio serves as a lifeline. It serves as a lifeline when the power goes out, it serves as a lifeline when the internet goes down. And when I say AM radio, I also mean AM and FM, terrestrial over-the-air radio, has far more utilitarian use than most people realize, including young people. It's just not the hip spot where young people may go for music discovery.
Yeah, but if you're going to lump both those things together, I have to tell you, most of the young people I know do know what FM radio is. That's still relatively popular, especially for music. It still sounds pretty good. It's the AM thing that I wonder. I mean, I'm here in Minneapolis. WCCO was one of the first original 12 clear channel stations, Class A in the United States. I saw the ratings for them last month. They were 19th. you know, and they, I mean, they used to like dominate not only just this area, but kind of basically the central U.S., you know. I probably don't have to tell you that. You probably know that. But I mean,
well, I mean, a lot of media that is rooted in the 20th century is having problems maintaining the same level of audience and domination of the culture that it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, because as we're in the 21st century, all media is competing against fractionalization, competing against exotic, new, non-regulated forms of media that are the result of the digital era. They're competing against changing culture in terms of a generation divide. The generation divide between the natives of the 20th century and the natives of the 21st century is one of the greatest divides we've ever seen. It's, yeah. It's gigantic. People that have children today born in the last 10 years, let's say, these kids are going to grow up to be so different than their parents that it's going to be in some ways problematic. It's already starting. As a matter of fact, parents of young children today will tell you that the kids don't seem like kids were when we were kids. They don't even seem like kids were 20 years ago. So these changes are impacting all of media. The fractionalization, there's no real mass media anymore. There's no more I Love Lucy show or Milton Berle show where everybody's watching it. The closest thing we have to that mystical thing where everybody's watching the same channel at the same time, I think at this point is in the United States, is the Super Bowl. And
but there's like one thing once a year. Right. And also, I'm skipping ahead here. You sing for the band Gun Hill Road, and I want to get to the history of that in a second. But your latest song is called Idiots. I'm not going to put any words in your mouth, but I could look at what's going on with the kids today and social media as basically kind of idiocy. I mean, I'm not going to get into the details. I was one of the developers of social media, and I regret it. I think it's done more harm than good myself. You know?
Well, technology is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
And we are living in an age where communications technology is just wreaking havoc with our brains and our nervous systems. The communications of today is rewiring the human nervous system. As a result of that, it's changing what we are, how we are, how we talk, how we relate to each other. So you're right. There's a downside to it. One of the problems with social media is the time suck. A lot of people just are addicted to it.
Yeah.
It's also a very dangerous medium for misinformation. Even on Facebook, people lie about their lives.
Oh, God. Yeah.
You know, so social media has brought with it a lot of problems. And back to what I said before about the parents not necessarily relating with the young people, a lot of the parents don't know the impact of social media. Another problem with social media for young people is the bullying aspect of it. When we were kids, you went to school and maybe you'd get in a fight in the schoolyard, you'd be picked on by some kids or whatever, but then you can get away. These kids can't get away.
Right, that's right.
From the bullies.
Although you just said it as an offhand comment, but I think that really bears repeating about you said that a lot of parents don't even realize exactly how even social media works. I think that's probably true.
Oh, it is true. And that's part of what I said before about there being a disconnect between the generations in terms of the generational divide.
Yeah.
And it's going to get more so because people, again, I call it natives of the 20th century, people like you and me and many, if not most of the people watching this program are immigrants. Not from Mexico or other countries. They're immigrants from a place that's even further away. They're immigrants from the 20th century. And you can't go back. And we're operating in this new land. We're citizens. We're here. But we speak 21st century as a second language.
Yeah.
The kids born of this era are very facile, very nimble. They they're open to new ideas. They learn the technology. They're able to do it. Whereas we do so, and guys like you and me are cutting edge kind of guys.
Yeah,
we do so reluctantly, though, compared to the kids.
Yeah.
And they're pulling away from us faster than we're able to keep up.
That's correct. That is. All right. So, you know, I mean, I know you're really interested in AI. I'm a computer programmer. I'm not going to go there just for the very reason you said so. I'm 68 years old. I'm kind of done. It's a different deal. You know, it's a different world. I'm not going to learn it. So, I mean, do you think right now, do you think that AI is going to be the bane of the human existence, like a lot of these tech guys are talking, like Elon Musk and stuff?
I think it's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous. I think misinformation, truth, accuracy, information and misinformation, as I said that word, I think are great problems in terms of journalism, in terms of trust, in terms of being able to trust certain institutions that we hang our hat on. And it's bad enough that trust in institutions has been eroding in the past decade or two. But to have now this extra layer of AI to create misinformation and to create, you know, that term fake news is just frightening. On the other hand, again, technology is a double-edged sword. There are tremendous uses for AI. And it's like nuclear energy. You know, we can blow ourselves off the face of the earth, or we can create renewable energy for years to come.
Yeah.
It's how we use it. And we are facing that challenge right now, not only in terms of the arts, politics, and journalism, but in terms of the law. The legal community is having their hands full. It always takes the lawyers and the legislators a longer time. There's a lag to catch up with changes in technology that change sociology.
Well, the problem with the legislatures, and I'm not saying this to bash them at all, they're expected to be experts on pretty much everything, you know? And so how much can one person learn? I mean, like you said, you and I are kind of like cutting edge with this technology shit, but I you know, there's a lot of stuff I don't know, believe it or not. I know people don't believe that, but it's true.
Well, I mean, admitting that you don't know, knowing that you don't know and knowing what you don't know are steps toward enlightenment. People that think they know it all are the patsies. They're the ones that don't know what they know or don't know.
Yeah. Let me get back to just before we go on here. So what do you think is going to happen with terrestrial radio in the next 50 years? I mean, I use this. Here's the analogy I use. When is the New York Times going to stop printing a printed edition? And I think that will be after I'm gone. I think they got another probably good 50 years to go. But
when you're gone, they'll stop.
Yeah, because of that.
Like you said, they're going to do it until I'm gone. You know, I it's funny. But there's a bit of truth to it. There's going to be AM and FM radio and newsprint until every one of us from the 20th century are gone. And
yeah,
then it'll be gone.
That's right.
So 20 years from now, 30 years from now, I think print will be a tchotchke. It'll be something on the table. It'd be like a hurricane lamp.
Uh-huh.
Or believe it or not, an oil painting.
Yeah.
There won't be any need for it. And AM and FM radio will be gone. There'll be no, they won't, it'll be a, you know, emergency frequency or something. But 30 years from now is an eternity.
It is. That's right.
Yeah. 3 years from now is an eternity, the way things are changing and the way we live in moments, moment to moment to moment to moment. We have enough trouble keeping track of history. People, the attention span, part of the rewiring of the human nervous system that I talked about before, the attention span of people is frighteningly short. I think a recent Microsoft study in Canada found out that the attention span of humans is now about 2 seconds less than a goldfish. And
that's not, really?
Yeah, it's not a joke.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. It's
goldfish are not smart.
You know, if you get one and you go, ooh, it'll go, you know.
That's the part we'll pull out, Michael. Right there.
And that is my fish imitation, folks.
It was fantastic. It was great. So I read Talker magazine. So, answer me this. I'm reading this last couple weeks, and it appears that every single talk media corporation, either podcasting or radio, it seems like their revenues from the last quarter or two have dropped. Is something going on, or is it just cyclical, or seasonal or?
No, they're all going bankrupt. it's not just for the last few years. This has been a long process. Most of the major radio corporations in America are either in or flirting with bankruptcy. As a matter of fact, radio would be a much better business if it weren't in such smothering debt. And the debt was accrued during the era of consolidation, when suddenly the regulations limiting how many stations a company or an entity could own was really loosened up. And they started to, you know, companies start buying up every station they could to be the biggest player on the block.
Right.
Wall Street got into it. Banks got into it. They start throwing money at radio buyers, and the prices went up. The prices, you know, were appreciating at a level that was just amazing. And then all of a sudden, the bubble burst, and we're in the 21st century. You know, 2008 came along, things changed, and the big consolidators got stuck with a bunch of radio stations that they paid too much for. And the game ceased to be creativity and getting ratings and having revenue based upon your programming. And it became a business of kick the can down the road and get more loans and get more investors. And it became a game of raising money as opposed to selling advertising.
Well, if that's the case, would bankruptcy be a good thing in the sense that it might lower a lot of the cost of these stations after, you know, corporations actually go bankrupt? Could that help?
It could help. It won't help the corporations that go bankrupt, and it won't help some of the people that might lose their jobs in the interim. But ultimately, if you're a radiophile and you want to see AM and FM radio and all of its digital platform offshoots like podcasting, DAB, satellite radio, streaming radio, and the like, which I consider all to be different manifestations of radio, it would make it better in as much as it would give an opportunity for new blood to get in, smaller companies, so that there's more diversity of ownership and thus more diversity of programming and more opportunity for programming suppliers and equipment manufacturers and all of that to have business, more people to sell to, as opposed to one company controlling such a large percentage of the marketplace.
Yeah.
The people that would be attracted to buy the radio stations at bargain prices would be people that love radio. And we're seeing that in New York, where John Catsimatidis of Gristiti's supermarket fame and I think Empire Energy, he's a billionaire.
Yeah.
And a radio fan. He's an older fellow. He's also a native of the 20th century. He loved WABC, so he bought it. And he bought it at a bargain basement price, and now he's having a ball with it.
He's on the air, right?
He's on the air. He does a show. And He programs it out of a love for radio.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. So we may see more of that.
You know, I read some of your credits at the top of the show here, and you're kind of the Forrest Gump of media, if you don't mind my saying so. You're about to look at him. But the reason I brought that up is because you were basically involved in podcasting before it even had a name. So.
Yeah, I called it stickless broadcasting. For those that don't know, the stick is a term that old-time broadcasters use to describe a radio station. It's based upon the tower, the transmitter. So they call it, hey, you know, WABC is a great stick. You know, that's hey, got a good stick. A stick is a radio station with a license, a transmitter, and a tower. The traditional way it's done. Excuse me. When podcasting came on the scene, people did not, the term podcasting wasn't used all that much.
Right. And
I called it stickless. You were able to broadcast without a tower, without a transmitter, without a license. And it was like, you know, I used to call it, this is the best thing since sliced bread, my gosh, you know? And, we meaning talkers and yours truly as a broadcaster, we were way ahead of the curve on podcasting.
Yeah, so where do you think podcasting is going to go? Do you think there's going to be a shakeup in this business? It's enormously popular, but other than, well, I suppose, I mean, you could probably say that about regular talk radio, too. Other than a handful of shows, it's basically like a vast field of people doing this. And
podcasting is basically a way to do radio and video. If you're an amateur, most of it is amateurs.
Yes.
It's like the proliferation of baseball diamonds around the country. It doesn't mean that suddenly, the New York Yankees or the Boston Red Sox or the Minnesota Twins are going to have competition from the local high school.
That's a great analogy. I never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right.
Or the invention of the word processor. Was there, as a result of the word processor or the typewriter, were there more great novels being written? It's a populist thing, and the ones that are making it big are, again, the cream that rises to the top. Talent only goes, there's a lot of talent out there, but the really great talent is not ubiquitous. It rises to the top, and there'll be big podcasts, but it doesn't mean that podcasting, that everybody's going to make money in it. And a lot of the big radio companies immediately thought, wow, this is the next big thing. Let's get in on the ground floor.
Right,
making money. But most podcasts are amateur. I'm not going to say they stink because that's not kind. So I'll say they're amateur.
Yeah. Also, a lot of the amateurs don't stink. A lot of the professionals do stink. So
that's an irony. And that's a whole other topic. There are some, one of the things that commercial radio needs to do, if it gets its mind back on research and development, creating programming, making program directors again, as opposed to calling them brand managers. One of the things that it should be doing is looking at some of the fabulous talent on shows like this and on YouTube. YouTube has some of the best talk show hosts I've ever seen. They do great interviews. They do great interviews. Some of them actually take calls. Calls are not as big a deal in 2023 as they were in 1983 or 1973 because everybody's got their own platform. Everybody's in show business. They got their own Facebook page, their own X account. They're on Instagram. It's not that big a deal.
I think I've told you previously, I mean, I got to admit, we've been having trouble getting callers on the show, even though it's done entirely via video. And I think one of the reasons is because a lot of people like to be anonymous online. They want to troll, even though you can't actually call the show and not show your face. It's easy to do. We have instructions on how to do that. Still, I think a lot of people really don't want to be public, so they're not used to it. I think that's part of the problem.
I think that's part of it. But I think the bigger part of it is it's no big deal anymore to be on the radio or to be on television or to be on somebody's show. You have your own show.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. I heard myself on the radio. Remember when you were a kid, if somebody was on the front page of the local newspaper, my God, Johnny's on in the newspaper.
That's right. You
know, now there is no newspaper. And who reads it? And who cares? Yeah. The irony is everybody's in the ratings business, like what I do, follow me, click here. You know, it's like everybody has a show, everybody has a platform, everybody's into the ratings. Well, who's watching? Who's listening? Everybody's yelling and screaming, and not that many people are listening. And that's the real reason, in my opinion, that it's hard to get calls. And I'll tell you, don't feel particularly persecuted because you're not getting the amount of calls you want to get.
Oh, I don't. No, I don't.
They're having trouble getting calls on big radio stations.
Yeah, I know that. I know. And the other thing is that we don't have a lot of viewers on live, but we do have this is our 50th show, so I appreciate you being on. So we've been doing this for 3.5 months. So relatively speaking, our numbers on demand are quite good. I mean, I'm very, very pleased with that. But this is 11 p.m. at night Eastern, so my thought was people would grab their cell phone and crawl into bed and watch this. And I guess a few people are doing that, but so far not a lot. So
if you've got Taylor Swift instead of Michael Harrison, they would watch. I mean, why should the masses crawl into bed and watch this show?
You're just as beautiful as Taylor Swift. You know that, right?
I mean, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, but do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
It's, if you build it, they will not come anymore.
No, it's true. And the other thing is, and we're old enough to remember this. in the 1960s and 70s, if you put out a newspaper, you actually had to lay out solid lead type every single goddamn day.
Well, you see behind me, that is the first issue of Talkers. It's a newspaper. We're not a newspaper anymore. We evolved into a full color glossy magazine, and then it changed into an online thing. And when I got rid of the publication, the print publication, I did that while we were still on top. We weren't getting thinner. I just knew this is ridiculous, and we did so much better without it. But I miss the art form of the printed page. Now, I remember when it was type, and each letter, you had a rubber band around them, and they held them together with a string. Right. And I mean, it was so tedious.
Yes.
And if you look at old newspapers from the golden age of newspapers, early 20th century, even 1950, 1960, you see the letters are all crooked. They're not smooth. And, you know, our memory of them is these are big time newspapers, but they actually were very funky. And but I miss putting together the Talkers magazine on print. But why? It's an art that I don't need anymore. You know? What can I say? Yeah,
I got a guy that comes on here regularly named Daniel Perez. He's in the Bigfoot community, and he puts out the Bigfoot Times. And believe it or not, the Bigfoot Times is not online. He sends it out through the mail. It's a hard copy newsletter, and it's actually, I really like getting it because you don't get shit like that anymore.
Why doesn't he have it online? He'd do better.
He's just stubborn. He doesn't want to.
All right. Well, you know, I like the way you say the Bigfoot community.
Yeah, the Bigfoot community.
I'm not making fun of it.
You can make fun of it. It's fine.
I love these type of terms. When we started Talkers, I called it the talk radio industry. There were about 70 stations. It was no industry. It was a sideshow in the radio industry. And we called it the talk radio industry. What audacity. And of course, it was a self-fulfilling.
It was. Yeah. And now it's the talk television industry, too.
Yeah. You know? I came up with that as a result of the influence I had as the first managing editor of a long gone, but very, very historic and big time in its day trade publication in the radio business called Radio and Records.
Yeah.
R&R.
Yeah.
Its slogan was the industry's newspaper.
Yeah.
One industry was radio and records. That was the radio and record industry, not industries. Industry.
Yeah.
There's no industry now.
That was not an exaggeration, Michael. I mean, radio and records was the trade publication in the radio industry. It was. I don't have to tell you that.
Yeah.
You know,
but it was called the radio and record industry.
Right.
Think about that.
Hey, when did that fold up?
I don't know, about 12 years ago, 13 years ago.
Okay, I pulled something out of your biography here that I'm really curious about. So you owned the Springfield, Massachusetts radio station. What is it? A WSPR?
That what it was? Yeah, I owned it in the mid to late 80s.
Yeah, and you founded the Super Talk format. What was that?
Super Talk was an approach to talk radio that used the elements of top 40 and pop music radio. It was very fast paced. We had some shows that were presentations of just podcasts, one after the other. And we used interviews and little features and lots of sound effects. When we went to the callers, we go, line W, line S, line P, line R, line S, you're on the air. Hello, Michael. It was really jazzy. Now, in those days, this is pre-Rush Limbaugh. We were so ahead of the game. We talked about topics the way you would play records. And this is pre-Talkers. When I started Talkers in 1990, I approached the talk radio industry the same way as if it was popular music. We had charts for subjects. Charts for who the most talked about people were. We took the discipline and the formatics that made music radio so compelling, and we applied it to talk.
Do you think that, just doing that, did that help spread the format?
Oh yeah. I was a player in that, very much the way I was a player in the AOR movement. I was influential in having radio view the album track as the primary unit of measurement, as opposed to the 45 RPM single. That one, I used to lead the charge. Why are we allowing the record company A&R departments to program our stations? For example, if Rumours would come out by Fleetwood Mac, and everybody on Top 40 radio are playing, Rhiannon or whatever song, I may even be on the wrong album. I would be playing four or five of the tracks. And by the time the Top 40 stations got to them, because the record companies released them as a single, they were old songs. And go, we got something new for you. Here's You Make Love and Fun by Fleetwood Mac. What? That's been out for 8 months.
Did you have a lot of pushback on that? Were you that?
Record companies and the Top 40 stations used to make fun of us. They called us hippy dippy radio,
But
and
God, it worked.
it
It was
changed the
hugely
whole.
popular.
It changed the whole nature of records
It
and
did.
radio music research. Of course, we're at a time now where the album is no longer the primary unit of measurement. Right now,
No.
we're back to the track,
Yeah.
one song at a time.
Right.
So, it's a cyclical thing. Nothing is written in stone. Nothing is forever. Some things have a longer life than other things, but nothing is written in stone. Those of us who are in pop culture have to get used to that idea real quick. Otherwise, you wind up becoming stuck in the past and out of step with the present, believing that you're maintaining some type of a holy tradition when in fact you're not.
Well, you're pretty into science. Are you familiar with the concept of the singularity, that change will get to the point where it's completely constant, there's no plateaus, and then, the question, Ray Kurzweil wrote a famous book on this, and he's wondering, well, what happens to the human psyche when that happens? I mean, you brought up a really good example here about how things are cyclical, but what happens when the cycle never stops?
Well, I said something even before that I think is worthy of repeating. I said that the changes in communications technology are rewiring the human nervous system. Isn't
That was
that?
right.
That's what you just said. There's no
Yeah.
question. Now, the term singularity has many different angles on
It does.
expanding.
That's true. Right.
But
That was his meaning anyway, and he coined the term, so,
yeah, I have my own personal issues. We're going to go into the metaphysical track here. I don't know whether technology is the be all or end all of civilization's advancement. I don't know whether the most advanced civilizations, they talk about the Fermi paradox, and we're looking for techno signatures out there of other civilizations and, Dyson spheres. And I don't know if you follow all this stuff.
Yeah, I do.
That we only think in terms of life, which is what we are, life, biological carbon-based life units, that the only way we could advance is through technology. Maybe it's mastering time and space through something inside our minds. Maybe there's a spiritual aspect to advancement, and that these societies out there, or us someday, who get to this point, look back on the kind of culture we have as clunky and archaic, that all technology might just be a step toward some type of a higher mastery of time and space.
My term for that, Michael, is spiritual technology. I think,
No, I think that's a good term.
I think
I don't think many people will understand what we're talking about, but I
maybe
do
not.
believe, especially since you're known for mixing everything from conservative politics to the Bigfoot community,
That's right, I am.
I do think there are people watching us who are going, whoa, that's what I think.
Yeah, maybe. Well,
Are you stunned? Are you?
now I'm checking my list.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, Okay.
All right. Okay. So, all right. I just want to. I want let. I tell you what. Let's end with this. Give me a history of the Gun Hill Road Band.
When I was at WNAW FM in New York, I was the host of a morning show on a progressive rock station run by Metro Media, one of the earliest and hippest of the FM rock stations. The DJs used to play whatever they wanted. We were basically gurus of taste and pop culture. And there was a band in New York called Gun Hill Road. And they had a number of songs. They had a couple of albums. They had one hit single called Back When My Hair Was Short. And it's still played like on the 70s channel on Sirius XM. It's one of those cool, they call it a one-hit wonder. Well, they were not a one-hit wonder. They were on album rock radio. And I loved them and I played them a lot. I became friendly with the guys. And the band, eventually went on to its own. Each guy went their own way, but we remained friends. And then all of a sudden we started recording again 40
When was
years ago.
that? When did you start?
About 14 years ago, about 14, 15 years ago. And
Uh-huh.
I joined the band as a member of the band, as opposed to I was like the fifth Beatle. I was the DJ that promoted them. And then I actually became part of the band. And we have a really nice following all around the world based upon the long history of the band, its quirky, cool music, and some of these songs that we're doing. And the irony is, these songs are being fueled and popularized by talk radio, not music radio. Talk radio plays Gun Hill Road, partially because I'm in the band.
Yeah, I was going to say it's partly your involvement, I
But
assume.
our lyrics are based upon issues, not on, I mean, we do make love songs and nice songs and pretty songs, but the ones that are getting the big music video followings on YouTube are the ones that deal with, like we have a song called I Know You're Real,
Yeah.
which is about animal welfare and cosmic consciousness in terms of the human race's relationship with other life forms, both on the earth and elsewhere. We have a song called Idiots, which is about idiocy being the most dangerous force that can destroy
Yeah,
democracy.
I think I gotta clip that and play this at the end of this interview. I'm gonna do that.
And
That's
we have a song called I Got a Line in New York City, which I sing on lead. Its message is more in the video that we made all of the artwork on the video for I Got a Line in New York City, which folks is igotaline.com if you want to see it.
all
All
right.
the artwork is AI, every bit of
Oh,
it. It's
holy shit. That's amazing.
And that's the hook. Why talk radio has played it, but you can't see the AI.
Yeah.
The music is organic, but the artwork is AI, and it's like a fe it's like a computer fever dream. It's really cool.
Okay, now I'm getting off track here, but still, maybe you need some. I understand how like Chat GPT works, like getting all this text from the internet and going and plowing through it. I don't know if you know this, but we were just talking about this on the show a couple nights ago. The computing power to run that is absolutely enormous. The server farms they have to run, there's just this one stupid programmer, just huge. They're wasting water basically to cool the place down. But I don't understand at all AI artwork. I don't understand, like, for example, Google Pixel now has this phone where if somebody's not smiling, you can make them smile and you can't tell. You know, you can't tell that it's not real. Do you understand this? Can you explain this to me or us or?
I can use it for so many different things, but I haven't got a clue how it operates. I
Huh.
just know, I know how to drive my car, but I can't fix the engine.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty miraculous. But if you finesse it properly and you tell the computer what you want, and then it comes up with what you want, and then it's not exactly what you want. So then you tell it again and you find different words. It's like talking to Google. Some people get Google to work fast and some people go in the wrong direction. It's knowing how to finesse the computer. And what it does is it goes out instantaneously to all of the images that are out there and it blends them together to create what you like. Now, I can't tell you how the technology of this show that we're doing works. That, I'm on the one side of the screen, you're on the other. It's pretty miraculous.
It is.
It's as miraculous as it
Yeah,
is, but
right.
I know how to do it. So I know how to do AI art, but I don't know how it works. And I still think at this point the average person doesn't have a clue how anything on the internet works. And sometimes I think that even the technicians and even the nerds that run the whole operation don't fully understand how it works. That's just my instinct. I don't know.
Michael, I have to tell you, I actually understand how the internet works. I'm still fucking amazed that it actually does.
Well, that's a form of being in awe.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. So you got packets and they're assembled at the other end. And okay, and this all happens in like 1/1000th of a second. And it works most of the time. People complain. Yeah, go ahead.
Jim, isn't it amazing that radio works? Isn't it amazing that you could, talk into a microphone and blah, 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 goes into the air and we're eating it and breathing it and whatever, and it finds its way to the radio? And, how does Siri work? I shouldn't say that. She's going to start going, what do you want? You know, she has an attitude now. Siri used to go, hello, what can I do for you? Now Siri, hey, Siri. Hey, did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
All right. Goodbye, Siri. Go away.
I think Siri's getting tired of people swearing at her. That's what I think.
I'm done, Siri. It's over. Yeah, she comes on. And my wife thinks I'm crazy. I worry about Siri liking me. Eventually we're going to be having relationships.
You're right. I agree. I got Alexa here in my office and I'm constantly telling Alexa, thank you and please. And, it's like stuff. I mean, it's a machine, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know why I do it.
Yeah. We live in an amazing time.
Yeah, it is.
And what it does is, back to you asking me, how does AI work for art? It humbles me to know that there are some pretty smart people out there. I mean, in our business, Joe Blow is a genius. He created a format that everybody listens to. These are geniuses. Listen to the music they made. The guys that are sending these probes to Pluto and taking pictures and sending them, they're geniuses.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Very humbling when you stop and think about it. The guys that built the George Washington Bridge during the Depression without computers. Try figuring out how to do that.
Oh, hell, we even got to the moon without a computer. It's like fucking unbelievable. I can only speak for myself. As an arrogant young man, I thought I was really smart, but I had some doubts about my talent. I've come to the conclusion 60 years later, it was completely the opposite. I've actually got quite a lot of talent. I'm not very smart.
Well, again, I respect you for saying you're not very smart, because I realize the more that I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know. But if I may throw a bouquet at you, and I'm not saying this to patronize you, you should be very proud of you mentioned you're 68. I'm 38, but you're you should be very proud at your age, my age, many people of our generation are on the leading edge and using the wisdom and the experience and their connection to history in a very progressive and modern way. And when I say progressive, I don't mean that politically.
Yeah.
I think it's a cool thing. I know you're talented because I don't know how long have we been talking?
45 minutes.
I feel like we just started, which is a credit to you.
I appreciate that.
You said you were going to wrap it up. I said, did I fail as a guest?
No. We've been talking for a while. And, you just brought something up here, too. You're talking about being involved in podcasting before it even had a name. The thing that amazes me about podcasting, one of the things, I'm astonished how people really buy into these really long interviews. I mean, Joe Rogan does 2.5-hour interviews, and people listen to the whole thing. That surprises the shit out of me. It really does.
If it's good, if it's a compelling conversation. I think Jerry Seinfeld said it, that short-term attention span, which I talked about earlier as a problem, because most people do suffer from it from one degree to another. Yeah. But in general, I think Seinfeld said there's no such thing as short-term attention span. There's just stuff that doesn't engage people.
Right.
Very long time. Have you found yourself watching old movies and old TV shows that you thought were great when you were younger, and you
constantly
watch them now and you say, God, they're slow.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Here's an example. Do you know Carson, the Antenna TV runs Carson, the old Carson Tonight shows at 9 o'clock every night. You know, you ever watch them? Some of those interviews are quite boring. I mean, I got to admit, and Carson does a great job, you know, trying to keep the levity up, but still, you know, it's a lot of, I remember reading when Fallon started on the Tonight Show, he got his producers together and they watched hundreds of hours of this stuff and they came to the same conclusion. That really a lot of these interviews were actually quite boring, but you know,
yeah, you know, well, I understand that you're in a new movie, yeah, and that you're staying in the Hollywood Hills, you rented a house, oh yeah, we got a nice house up there, and we're down the street from Jack Benny, and you know,
and you and I and five other people listening to this, and the only people know who Jack
you
Benny
can't
is.
Pull it in anymore. There's no such thing as filler.
No, there is.
There's no such thing as free media. Time is as valuable as bottled water, which costs more than gasoline. Yeah. So we're talking about when you're having people watch you, you can't waste their time. You know, yeah. If I came on and said, "Hey, Jim, you know, it's before I got here, I was had to deal with the guy that was mowing the lawn outside in front of the building, and you know, he told me, you know, how was your weekend?" And then 5 minutes into it, we start to talk about what's going on. Goodbye. People are not going to listen. People don't have time. Every second of media time, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a show, whether it's radio, whatever, it has to be good. So it's a credit to Joe Rogan that he has shows that are long form and high in terms of, you know, audience numbers.
Yeah. Although I do have to ask you, you've been in this business a very, very long time. I think, especially when it comes to talk media, there's a certain comfort in just listening to people talk pleasantly. I don't know if that's because I think a lot of people are lonely. I mean, am I on to anything here, or do you disagree?
You're definitely on to something there. Radio is an antidote to loneliness, but radio has to be, it has to be good. People want to hear some, they want to take away. They don't just want to hear people droning on and talking. Usually the comfort level that you're describing, it comes along with some type of meaningful message. Uh-huh. And as I said before, you're not as kind as you think you are. If you're listening to something, you will find if it's not meaningful, you're going to tune out. And, yeah. And back to what I said before about some of our favorite movies, I watch them now. Oh my God, I can't believe how long this scene is going. Yeah, right. And I'll tell you something else. With all due respect to the great giants of radio that built this business over the last 100 years, sometimes I listen back to the tapes of DJs that I thought were the greatest thing and inspired me to go into the business. And I listen to it and I go, what was so good about that? It wasn't that.
Yeah.
So much of what we like has to do with where we're at.
Correct.
When we consume it. I call it the greatest pizza in the world syndrome. Most people think the greatest pizza they ever had was the local pizzeria in the neighborhood they grew up in.
Yeah. Well put. Yeah. You're a smart guy.
it takes one to know one. Thank you.
Hey, Michael, thanks for coming on today. It's our 50th show, and I really, really appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy, and so I can't thank you enough.
I hope the listeners enjoyed this half as much as I've enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, man. That's
You're doing a great job. Best wishes to you, Jim. And I hope I can come back because we really scratched the surface.
Absolutely. Absolutely can. Thank you.
Take care.
We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Got to unmute myself. That's Michael Harrison. He's the founder and publisher of Talkers Magazine. Like you heard, he's done everything. I think I described him at one point as the Forrest Gump of media. I mean, it's unbelievable the stuff he's done. And he's about 70, if I'm right. I think he's only a couple years older than me. Oh, and by the way, I realized listening to that, I forgot to actually grab a copy of that song, Idiots, and play it tonight. I promise you I will play it at the end of the show tomorrow night. We're going to do that for sure. Because, yeah, we share the same sentiment there. You know, I was talking about that even the first block, you know. People, especially the younger people, do not seem to be that smart. Yeah. So anyway, give me a call if you want. JimAtKnight.com/call. I got some paranormal and UFO news here I want to run by you. First of all, this is really fascinating. So thousands of people have lined up for a chance to get Elon Musk's oh God, Jim, Neuralink. Right, thank you. Jesus, you thought overthought it. Neuralink chip installed in their brains. Yeah, you so he wants to install a chip in your head that will directly connect your brain to the internet. No fucking lie. This is what he's doing. Now the problem is here. So they want to roll this out. Thousands of people have already applied. The idea is, I think if I'm, this is off the top of my head, I think they want to do 28,000 of these before 2030, and they only want to do 11 next year. But most of the chimps, they use chimpanzees to do the experiments of the surgeries to do this. Most of them died. So God bless you, you know. If the internet's that important to you. Yeah. So the deal is, so the way it works is that they take a tiny little chunk out of your cranium or your skull behind your one of your ears, and they put the chip in that place. But the other thing, the thing that, excuse me, sorry, the thing, wow, the thing that gets delicate about this whole thing is there's about 64 tiny, tiny little wires in this chip that have can connect inside your brain. Yeah. So what they're trying to do, what Elon Musk is trying to do, is he's trying to train robots to do these surgeries basically automatically with no human intervention, and that hasn't worked out too well so far. So anyway, yeah, but they want to do about 28,000 of them in the next 7, 8 years. Yeah, that'll be interesting. I think I'm going to pass on this. Just like I was talking to Michael Harrison. You know, okay, I'm not going to learn it. I don't want to learn AI. I'm a computer programmer. I'm not going to learn it. I don't care. You know, I'm done. You know, so yeah, I'm gonna be one of these old farts who's gonna talk about, yeah, I remember when we did the internet in 1995. You know, it's like, yeah, grandpa, or one of the, okay, boomer. That's gonna be me. I don't care. I don't. You know, I still got the money. So, okay. So what else? Oh, this is something that Jazz Shaw talked about last week on the show. He's a weekend editor for hotair.com, and he's also the UFO guy for Salem Media. And he was mentioned talking about this already, and that is Sean Kirkpatrick, the guy who runs the Anomaly Resolution Office, Alderman Anomaly Resolution Office, which is basically the reporting office now for UFOs and UAP. Well, he's quitting. He's stepping down. So it is ostensibly because of pressure he got from a lot of the whistleblowers who didn't like him. I don't know if that's the real reason, and Jazz didn't either. You know, Jazz thought that maybe actually this was prearranged, that he would only do this for a certain amount of time, because this person's really in a hard spot here. You know, I've talked about this before. There's been a struggle in the Pentagon for a good 40, 50 years now on whether to tell the public about the extraterrestrials, because David Grush, he appeared before Congress, and not only did he tell Congress, the committee, that we had crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft, he even said we have dead alien bodies. And you know, this has been well known in the internet community, the UFO community for some time, but the question in the Pentagon has been whether they should tell the public. And apparently this has been a huge struggle. And one of the reasons they don't want to tell the public is because many of the techniques they've used to keep this from the public are probably illegal. So now this got kind of lost in the shuffle here, but the reason Grush and these other people like Ryan Graves came forward is because they were promised immunity from any prosecution by testifying. So the RO office, the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, they have a mandate of Congress. Anybody who wants to blow the whistle on any UFO activity automatically gets immunity. Now, if they extend that to anybody who knows anything, whether they're actually quote-unquote whistleblower or not, this will probably come out, this whole thing will probably resolve really quickly. But the problem right now is there's a lot of people who are looking at jail time for what they did. Now, I'm not going to get, you know, I've speculated on this. I've talked about this. You know, there are people who think that that the government has even murdered people to keep this secret. So, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't. I personally have that. That's a personal speculation on my part and the speculation of others. But there's no real evidence to this. But there have been some really, really weird deaths. Now, in January, we're going to have Stan Gordon on the show. And he's the guy, but last week, I forgot his name. So I didn't even talk about it. I ended the show without talking about this. Stan Gordon, he grew up in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. And in Kecksburg, that's where the Kecksburg UFO incident happened in December 1965. He grew up in that small town. And that basically, he went on to become basically a paranormal investigator. I mean, he started with UFOs, but now his big thing is Bigfoot. Matter of fact, he told me, he said when he comes on the show, he wants to spend a lot of time talking about Bigfoot, because that's what he's been doing lately. But the fact is, there was a guy who worked at the radio station in Kecksburg at that time, and like I said then, and it's apropos to the conversation we just had with Michael Harrison. In 1965, even small-town radio stations were big deals. They were, if your town had a radio station, which was almost inevitably at that time AM, FM didn't raise its ugly head till the 1970s. If you had a radio station, that was like real media in your town. So John Murphy put together a documentary on this crashed object, and he says he found out what it was through back channels, talking to the military and all this sort of stuff. What happened was this thing, this capsule, crashed in the forest out right outside of Kecksburg, a tiny little town about 50 miles, I think, southwest of Pittsburgh, if I'm right. And about two dozen of the people in the town saw it before the military came and hauled it away. Now, the amazing thing is the military arrived within less than 2 hours. So obviously they had been tracking this thing. And the other weird thing is that people who had followed this both on radar and people who visually saw it land said it was not, it didn't act like a meteor in the sense that it did not come right through the atmosphere and like crash. It did turn, change course, and people said it came to a quote unquote soft crash landing. In other words, it tried not to crash. That's what they said. And apparently people who tracked it on radar, like NORAD, they said the same thing later. Now this is all, you know, secondhand, of course, you know, I wasn't there. But they said that the thing changed direction, too. Things that fly in from space on their own accord can't do that. So it was obviously an intelligently controlled craft. And the people who said, who found it in the woods said it was about the size of a large car, like a Volkswagen minibus, and it had strange hieroglyphic writing on it. So the army showed up, the military showed up in less than 2 hours and hauled it away. Nobody knew it was. Also, the army lied about what it was. They said it was a meteor. They told the public that, no, you're mistaken. It's not a space capsule. It's a meteor. Well, okay, fine. Bullshit, you know. And so Murphy, this guy named Murphy, and I didn't know this, but Stan told me this in a recent communication, a recent email exchange, that he actually didn't know John Murphy. I thought he did. But Murphy, this guy from the radio station, in Kecksburg, he did a radio documentary and was going to tell the public what this thing was. And the government came and basically, they threatened his life or his family because he immediately pulled it. It ended up running, but it was highly edited. There's nothing in it. He took out everything of any substance. So it did technically run. Well, his wife and others who knew him said he became despondent for years. She basically like clammed up socially permanently. 3 or 4 years went by, and I think it was 1969. He changed his mind. He said, "I'm going to tell people what I know." So he was going to put the radio documentary back together, and he very conveniently died in a car accident on a hit and run. Somebody forced his car off the road. It's like, well, okay. All right. And, you know, and even Gordon said this in the email he sent me. There's no proof that he was killed, and there isn't. But the problem is so many of these things happen at so many unopportune times that you start to wonder. Who's the guy who played John Mulch on Homicide? Oh God damn it! The comedian. Now I've talked about him before. Now I'm not gonna forget his name. Oh Jesus Christ! Any rate, he wrote a book called Hit List. He was also a conspiracy theorist, and he said, him and his partner figured out that there were about 300 people in Dealey Plaza at the moment John F. Kennedy was shot. And he said that about 78 of them died within, was it 5 years of the shooting? And he ran a formula. And the amazing thing is, in the book Hit List, in the one of the first couple of chapters, they actually print the formula. He said he was tired of people naming these odds, but he said the chances of that happening based on background from the general population, in other words, people dying at random, was 16 trillion to one. And they published the formula in the book. Oh, God, what's his name? Richard Belzer. That's his name. Yeah, Belzer, yeah. Yeah, he did. He died about, what, a couple, 2-3 years ago. He wrote about a half a dozen books based on all sorts of theories about how Princess Diana died, the UFO stuff, the JFK stuff. He had a co-writer for all those books, and I'm trying to get that guy on our show. I would, you know, we're not going to talk to Belzer, unfortunately. He's in the great beyond. But I'm trying to get his, a guy's name is, if I'm right, it's Dwayne Nelson, is it? All right. You know, I'm just pulling stuff out of my butt. What do I know? Why are you even listening to this? You're listening because it's a 50s show, and we're kind of kicking ass. It's like, I have to tell you, I thought the interview with Michael Harrison, he's just an endlessly fascinating guy. You know, it's amazing. You get older men, you know, who've had just a series of incredible experiences. And he's one of them, you know. I got a couple other things I want to bring up here, too. Oh, here's, this is really interesting. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of this. If you work at Area 51 in Nevada, which is about 80 miles out from Las Vegas, you get to work every day on an airplane, on an airliner. And that airline that does that for the government is called Janet Airlines. Now, so apparently, it's JNT was some sort of acronym, and nobody really knows what it was, but that's how it got the name Janet. And they're unmarked airplanes. Now, I'm not kidding about this. They're unmarked 707s. There's about six of them that fly a bunch of people. What is it, about 140 people from Las Vegas to work every day at Area 51? You can drive into Area 51 if you have credentials. If you don't have credentials and you try, they'll shoot you. And they do that. They have done that. So people have been flying into work at Area 51, the most top secret facility basically on the entire planet. And the government is now looking for a new contractor to run this little airline, if you're interested. I just want to point out, you know. So you got six airplanes. There's 737-600s. They take off from Harry Reid International Airport in Las Vegas, and they fly to Area 51 and other secret locations, which those are really secret. So Area 51 is not secret. You know, we know where the runways are there, all sort of shit. But so it was Robert Lazar who said he worked about 15 miles south of Area 51 in a facility called S4. By the way, Area 51, if you're wondering how it's named off of the particular grids on a map that the U.S. Army did of the Nevada test site range. So technically, if I'm right, Area 51 is part of the Nevada test site range, which is a huge, huge body of desert in Nevada that the government owns. And they fly shit over there. They land shit. One of the reasons they picked that particular spot in Area 51 is it's on the shore of Groom Lake, which is a dried, archaic lake bed. And I don't know if you know this, it's really easy to land airplanes on a dry lake bed. You don't really need a runway. They put in runways anyway, but you don't. If something goes wrong, you're not going to crash your airplane. You can still land. This is like when they do land speed records. They do those on dry lake beds too, because you have miles and miles in every direction of perfectly flat sand. You know, so Anyway, if you want to run that, you can make a make a bid to the government to run this airline if you want to do that. And finally, I'm just going to read this just verbatim because it just kind of amuses me. According to Psychology Today, studies of people who report seeing UFOs show that they are generally not psychopaths or individuals seeking attention, but are open to the possibility that they experience something unexplainable. The history of science shows that many ideas seem crazy until they're proven correct. So we shouldn't jump to conclusions about those who claim they've had UFO and alien encounters. Yeah, you're looking at it. Yeah, don't judge me as crazy. That's what I told my friends in the broadcasting community for 30 years. I'm talking on the air talking about UFOs. Everybody says, he's nuts. Well, it turns out I wasn't. Okay, there you go. And I'm hanging my hat on that. And folks, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it completely. Tomorrow night, Jeff Meyer joins us. I'm going to play the song Idiots by Gun Hill Road at the end of the show. We'll do that. Jeff always has something interesting to say. I don't got anything for Thursday so far, but we'll put something together. We'll figure it out. Next Wednesday, JFK special. And let me see. The week after that, believe it or not, is the third or fourth Republican debate. And it looks like there's probably only going to be three people on stage for this. So now it's really interesting. So we did the previous three debates. The first one was bad. The second one was god awful. It was terrible. But this last one, you know, last week was not too shabby. You know, people actually said some interesting things. So hopefully that'll happen again with only three. It looks like only three people are going to be involved. So Tim Scott, of course, dropped out. And I don't know if Christie or a couple other people are going to make it. So at any rate, that's what it looks like right now. So that's Wednesday, December 8th, if I'm right. And we're going to have our usual debate panel. I want to thank you folks for watching. First of all, for watching the show, but even that, the last debate panel, we had a pretty good crowd watching that. That was pretty good. So it was pretty funny too. I like those guys. And so they're coming back on. So at any rate, I'm Jim Peters. Thanks for watching our 50th show here, whether it be Rumble or whatever. You know, I hate to say this, you know, and Michael talked about this too, you know. If you want to, like, follow us on, especially Rumble, or like us or whatever, please do so, if you feel so inclined. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. I'll see you tomorrow.